Today, we're delighted to have with us Dr. Michael Motley. Dr. Motley is a chairman and professor of rhetoric and communication at the University of California, Davis, and he's here to tell us about how we can lick speech anxiety. Would you please welcome Dr. Michael Motley. Dr. Motley?
Thank you. Does the volume seem about right on this? Is that okay? Let me start off by trying to clarify what I think we can and cannot accomplish in the next hour or so. It's a safe bet that a large number of you experience anxiety in giving speeches. And I say that's a safe bet because surveys tell us that. Surveys that ask adults in the United States, for example, to name their fears, determine that the number one fear in the United States among adults, ranking above the fear of heights, snakes, financial ruin, even death, is the fear of speaking before a group. About 85% of Americans report this kind of anxiety, or as one of my colleagues likes to put it, 85% admit speech anxiety and the other 15% lie, which is sort of probably an exaggeration, but maybe not very much of one. It's also a safe bet that for some of you, a few of you, it's more than just a nuisance. Certainly for some individuals, the problem is severe and debilitating. In my private practice, I've counseled people who are on the verge of quitting their professions altogether because the profession demands public speaking. Some cases, by the way, these are situations where it's sort of obvious at the outset that public speaking is a requirement. I'm talking about ministers and attorneys and public relations executives, for example. More typical, perhaps, is that a number of people pass up opportunities for advancement because a promotion means having to give speeches, and they'd just as soon not have the promotion if it means that. So certainly for some people, this is serious. So it's widespread, it's serious. What I wish I could say we could do today is to cure everybody's speech anxiety. We don't have enough time, and we have too many people to do that. But what I think we can do and what I hope to do is to give you some information on the nature of the problem. In doing that, maybe reduce everybody's own anxiety a notch or two. And in the process of doing that, for those who do have more extreme anxiety, perhaps give some assurance that more progress is fairly realistic in the hands of a competent therapist. That's sort of where I want to go. Let me start off with the nature of the problem and talk about three components primarily, one of which you're already familiar with. By the way, I'm going to, just for the heck of it, just to make things easier, I'm going to start calling it stage fright. Technically, we call it public speaking anxiety. But I want to make clear that I'm only talking about the kind of stage fright that applies to public speaking. Some of what I'll say during the first part of the talk would apply to any kind, but toward the end, what I'm going to be saying won't help you very much if you're talking about concert pianists or actors or that sort of thing. So I'll call it stage fright, but I'm talking about stage fright in public speaking. Anyway, there are three components that I want to talk about, one of which I'm pretty sure most of you are already familiar with. I'll just call it ANS for right now. I'm talking about autonomic nervous system arousal, the physiological arousal, psychophysiological arousal that accompanies the anxiety. The butterflies in the stomach, the shaky hands, the dried out mouth, the sweaty palms, whatever it may be for each individual person. This much I think you're familiar with. Most of you have experienced it. There are a couple of aspects of the physiological dimension, though, that I would like to talk about that I think are interesting and potentially helpful. If you look at the pattern of physiological arousal that takes place before, during, and after public speaking, here's what you find. Here's what we found, anyway. Let's let this be arousal. We happen to have measured it with heart rate. Let's let this be normal resting heart rate, 72, 78, around in there somewhere. And let's let this be time. Heart rate in beats per minute, okay? Most of you know from your own experience that prior to the speech, there's a little elevation in the overall arousal. You're above rest. It's a little anxiety already detectable. Then let's say this is the point at which the speech starts. When you get up and face the audience, bingo. It shoots way up there. We've recorded heart rates over 200. And as many of you know, that's way, way, way up there. More typical, 140, 180, around in there is more typical for the normal speaker. Now that doesn't surprise very many of you either, and especially doesn't surprise the high anxiety speaker. The high anxiety speaker can tell us this already. What is a little bit surprising though, I think, and maybe a little bit helpful, is this, that across time, after about a minute for the normal speaker, this starts coming down, starts adapting, so that by the end of the speech, and the particular study I'm thinking of was one that involved 5-minute speeches, and I don't know whether if it's a 1-hour speech, if it goes down in 5 minutes or if it just gradually goes down to the bottom after an hour, I'm not sure of that. But anyway, there is an adaptation pattern that takes place. Many speakers, when we've done artificial things to make sure that the adaptation doesn't happen, I won't tell you about that, that was before we were so concerned about subjects' rights, those subjects tell us, well, that's what always happens to me in a speech. We sort of apologize for keeping the level up there so high throughout the entire speech, and people say, no, I always get that big surge at the beginning and then stay there throughout the rest of the speech. That's not true. People adapt. One other thing I want to mention, and then I'll tell you the point here for reducing anxiety a little bit, is that here's the pattern for the unusually low anxiety speaker. Not quite as much arousal, but still a little bit more than rest before the speech starts. And then when the speech starts, the confrontation reaction, what we call this initial reaction, is still there. It goes up and way up compared to rest, but not nearly as high as for the normal or highly anxious speaker. The other difference is that it only lasts a little while. We're talking now about 10, 15 seconds, something like that. Usually by the time for the low anxiety speaker, by the time they're finished with the introduction, it's back down and the acceleration is much faster. So the pattern is like that. Now there are a couple of messages here, I think, if you are one of these. One is to monitor the pattern and notice that you do adapt. We've had some luck telling students to monitor this adaptation process so that after a couple of minutes they sort of do a reading and say, gee whiz, I am better off now than I was a little while ago. That gives some assurance, accelerates the adaptation even more. They check a little bit later and say, gee, now I'm a lot better than I was before, and it can accelerate the adaptation. The other point, though, is that this gives us a little bit of an idea of what the realistic targets are as far as the physiological component for speech anxiety. What a lot of us would like to think as the target is this: normal resting heart rate, never a blip. That's unrealistic. Even the most calm speakers have a little bit of this surge. The good news is it just doesn't last very long. We like to tell speakers that the idea is not to get rid of the butterflies like this, but merely to make them fly in formation. And what we mean by that is you're never going to get rid of all of it, but you can get it down to a level that it's easy to handle. So much for the physiological component. I'll mention one more thing about it a little bit later. There are a couple of other components that I think maybe you're not so familiar with. One is, I won't draw the arrows yet. Let me just put the circle. Let me just represent it with the psi for psych. A psychological interpretation of the physiological arousal. Now we're at the theory level and nobody knows for sure that it works this way, but this is the way at least some people are modeling it these days. If you have, according to one model, physiological arousal and it's unusually high, then we have to come up with some explanation for that. We have to explain that arousal. Supposedly the way it works here is people say, gee, there's something funny going on inside me, butterflies, sweaty palms, and so forth, what's going on? And then you have to label it, label the emotion. Some people can say, well, that shows that I'm psyched up, I'm emotionally ready for the speech. But what most of us do, of course, is we say, well, it sure feels a lot like fear. And we label it as fear. Then what happens, supposedly, and I think there's something to this, is we have to say, well, okay, then if I'm afraid, what is it that I'm afraid of? And at that point, supposedly, we start inventing all kinds of catastrophes that justify the fear. I'm afraid that if I make a mistake, the audience is going to ridicule me. I'm afraid I'm going to make a fool out of myself. I'm afraid of this. I'm afraid of that. Because that justifying that fear is something that we have to do psychologically to create a balance. The interesting thing about this process, I think, and especially when it comes to therapy, is that often those rationalizations are being redundant here. Often those justifications are irrational. Let me give you a simple example now, and then I'll give you more examples toward the end. I'll ask students in my public speaking classes, hey, you're experiencing some anxiety, tell me something. What is it that you're afraid of? I mean, exactly, what is it that you're afraid of? And the answer, this is a game, I know what they're going to say, with about 90% confidence anyway, I'm afraid of the grade. To which my reply is, great, I'll make you a deal. I won't grade you, therefore you won't have any stage fright, right? And of course, it doesn't work that way. They realize as soon as that bargain is struck that no, the anxiety is still there. That's not what they're afraid of. They're not afraid of the grade. And you can go on and on and on and on in therapy and show people that what it is that we think we're afraid of is fairly irrational. One more example, then I'll get on to something else. I'm afraid if I make mistakes, the audience is going to ridicule me. What kind of mistakes? Well, if I forget my place, or if I make a verbal slip, or I spill my water, or something like that. To which the reply is, well, look, put yourself in the place of the audience. Imagine yourself sitting out there watching somebody else's speech, and they forget a word, or make a verbal slip, or spill their water, or something like that. Do you sit there and say, ha, 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 you screwed up? No, we don't do that as audience members. And audience members don't do it to us, and on and on and on. But all kinds of examples of fears that are invented here, or if not invented, at least formulated, which upon closer examination end up appearing fairly irrational. One more component, and it's the one I'm going to concentrate on the most. It's the one that guides my approach to therapy. The model so far goes like this. We have this psychophysiological arousal. It activates some psychological interpretations. To go a step further, if these are catastrophic enough, it feeds back and makes these even greater. If this gets excessive, then the interpretations have to become excessive, and we cycle back and forth, and we end up with people convinced that they're going to make a fool out of themselves, and therefore having incredibly high arousal. The question at this point is the chicken or egg question of which comes first and what gets this whole ball rolling in the first place. Where does this come from? Why does it even start? And if we didn't have this, we wouldn't have to have this. I'm becoming more and more convinced intuitively, and have started doing some research to get empirical support, more and more convinced that underlying this process is yet another component that has to do with our cognitive orientation to the public speaking situation. I'll put it up here. And specifically what I'm talking about is this. There are a couple of ways of viewing a speech. One of them, there are lots of ways, but I'm talking about two extremes of a continuum. One of them is inherently anxiety arousing, and the other one isn't. Some people approach a speech as a performance, and that's the orientation that creates a lot of anxiety. As a matter of fact, when I talk about cognitive orientation as a problem, I'm generally talking about, let me just call it, a performance orientation. Performance orientation is this. Giving a speech is sort of like figure skating in the Olympics or diving in the Olympics or doing a gymnastics floor routine in the Olympics or something like that. You have a bunch of people out there who are critics. They're judges. That's their function. And if you're starting to say, hold it, that's silly, that's my point. A bunch of people out there are serving as critics. What they do is they have this sort of mental tally sheet of certain kinds of skills that are supposed to be demonstrated in a speech. And at the end of the speech, they sort of rack up a score and hold up a scorecard in their mind. And you get a 10 if you're good, and you get less than that if you're not. In other words, the idea is that that what makes a good speaker is someone who displays good oratorical skills, and part of the idea here is that that's what the audience is looking for. The other approach, the other end of the continuum, says humbug. That's not what speaking is all about. The object of a speech is to get certain ideas across to an audience, certain messages, to share certain information with an audience, and the speech is a good speech if that's accomplished, regardless of the behavioral skills. One approach says the object is aesthetic. The other approach says the object is pragmatic. And that performance approach, the one that concentrates on aesthetics, has all kinds of anxiety components built in. Things like this. It implies that the situation is a novel situation. And we experience anxiety in novel situations in all kinds of contexts. It assumes that giving a speech means that you have to be unusually formal. And inherent in that is the notion that maybe I, as a speaker, don't know how to be that formal. I don't know what the rules are. That's going to create anxiety. It gives you the idea that people are sitting there scrutinizing you, putting you under a microscope. That creates anxiety, and there are all kinds of things that go along with that. I'll talk much, much more about this in a little while, but the flip side, to exaggerate for right now and to make the point, and then I'll temper it later, the flip side says, look, if you have certain ideas, certain main points that you want to get across to the audience, and you do that, then it's a good speech, even if you were giving it standing on your head with your back to the audience. That's what matters. So we have these two different approaches, and basically I'll be blending them in a minute and sort of show you how the therapy can go. Now, if these are the three components, oh, by the way, let me just mention one other. These are the three that I'm going to concentrate on, especially the third. This is not to mean that there aren't other aspects of speech anxiety as well. There are all kinds of other little minor ones. The three that we're talking about so far take place before the speech and take place during the speech. There are all kinds of other little things that take place only during the speech. For example, one is the speaker's perception of the audience's perception of the speaker's anxiety. Goes like this. Oh my gosh, they can tell my voice is quivering. That makes it worse. Now, oh my gosh, they can tell my hands are shaking. That makes it even worse. Now, oh my gosh, they can tell my knees are shaking. Oh my gosh, they can tell I fainted. It gets worse and worse and worse. Fact of the matter is that the audience can't tell. Those rare times where we as audience members have been able to tell that somebody has unusual anxiety, we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg. But all kinds of studies demonstrate that audiences are very poor guessers as to speakers' anxiety. Anyway, if these are the three components, left out arrows, by the way, I'm claiming this in effect. And if we want to say, okay, let's figure out how to do therapy to take care of the problem, then it makes sense that we could aim our therapy at any of the three components. And as a matter of fact, that's exactly what goes on in therapy for speech anxiety. There's a very popular approach to therapy that's aimed primarily at the autonomic nervous system arousal component. Systematic desensitization, some of you are familiar with it. I don't want to talk about it very much right now, but basically it involves getting people to visualize aspects of public speaking, and to do that while in a physiologically relaxed state, starting first with visualizing things that are fairly remote from giving one's own speech, like being in the audience while somebody else is, or something like that. Can you do that without arousal? Okay, then let's go up to the next step. Can you visualize preparing your own speech? Can you do that without experiencing arousal? Okay, if you can do that, let's go up to the next one. Can you visualize yourself getting dressed the morning of your speech, driving to the speech, being introduced, giving the speech, and so forth? A technique that's effective, especially in certain situations, but one that I don't want to talk about too much today because it's not one that I use. Another approach concentrates primarily on this component, the interpretation. Basically, the way this works is sort of like I described a minute ago. Tell me what it is that you're afraid of, and I'll show you why you shouldn't be afraid of that. And that's overly simplistic, and again, I don't mean for a minute to not this approach. Rational emotive therapy is the name for it. Some of you are familiar with that. Again, very, very effective. I use a little bit of it, but not exclusively. It's another approach, obviously, you can tell where I'm going with this, I think, that says let's concentrate on this other dimension. If it's true that it's the one that gets the ball rolling, that it makes sense that if we could take care of it there, we can sort of nip it in the bud. And that's another therapy approach, and I'm going to talk more about it, partly because it's mine and partly because it's fairly new, and I think that probably not many of you have heard about it. Basic idea here is to replace the performance orientation with a communication orientation. When that takes place, two things happen. I'm just convinced. Ask me at the end what's the nature of my evidence and I'll gladly tell you, but I don't want to get into that right now. I'm just convinced that what almost always happens, and I won't say always, but almost always happens, is that the anxiety goes way down and the quality of the public speaking goes way up. And those two go together. And part of the difficulty in the therapy is not so much convincing people that the anxiety will go down if they abandon the performance approach. I think in the next 15 minutes, you'll see the logic that says that if I had a communication approach or if somebody has a communication orientation instead of a performance orientation, logically it makes sense that there's not as much cause for anxiety. Difficult part is convinced me that that's the right way to give a speech, because that's not the way I was taught to give speeches. But I think both of those things happen. The anxiety goes down and the level of the speeches goes up. Let me give you a simple example. Sort of, this is a tangent. One characteristic of performance, whether you're talking about a piano recital or whether you're talking about a figure skating routine or a stage actor or whatever it may be, is memorization. When you perform things, and at least in those sort of traditional contexts, you memorize them. We who teach public speaking advise against memorization all the time for two reasons. One is that it makes for lousy speeches. And I think you know why. You've been in audiences where somebody has given a speech that's memorized. How do you know? Because you can tell. It sounds phony. And not only does it sound phony, but there's information that's being lost. The vocal inflections are different, and the vocal inflections that carry information in ordinary conversation are altered, and you're losing information, and it sounds like you're listening to a travelogue. The other thing that happens, though, when you memorize a speech, is that the anxiety goes up, almost always. And that sounds at first counterintuitive, because that's the reason that people memorize them in the first place. They say, gee, what if I forget what I'm going to say, something like that? How can I be sure that I'm going to get it exactly right? Well, I know, I'll memorize the thing. That way I can't miss. But many of us have had experiences in the past with piano recitals and reciting poems and the Gettysburg Address and things like that. We know what happens when you've got something memorized and you come across a glitch. The entire system shuts down. Maybe you can retrieve it by going back to the beginning of the measure or the sentence. Usually you have to go all the way back to the beginning of the phrase or the paragraph. Sometimes you have to go all the way back to the beginning of the text. Because when something's memorized and it shuts down, you're stuck. And I think on a subconscious level, people who memorize speeches know that. The anxiety goes up and the performance in the other sense, the quality of the speech goes down. All kinds of other examples of that. But let me try to highlight the remaining time three particular foci of efforts to change the performance orientation into communication orientation. And by the way, I think that even if you don't happen to be one who experiences anxiety with public speaking, you can interpret some of these as tips for effective speaking anyway. Three levels, I think, three that I want to talk about anyway. One part of the effort in the therapy is to give people a new orientation on what success means in the context of public speaking. And I've addressed this a little bit. I'm going to repeat myself to make the point here. The performance approach says success means you satisfy a bunch of behavioral criteria and you impress the audience as a speaker. You want the audience to go away liking you and praising you as a speaker. And the way you do that is you make a favorable aesthetic impression. The other side says, forget that. Just get certain communicative points across to the audience, and that's all you need to do. Now, I hope you can see that the first approach intuitively seems a little bit more anxiety arousing than the second one. It goes sort of like this. Performance orientation, okay, they're going to be looking at certain behaviors, they're going to be examining my gestures and my choice of words and my voice and my eye contact and this and that and the other thing. So I know what it is that they're going to be looking at, but I'm not that experienced a public speaker, so I'm not sure exactly what the rules are. I don't know if I can give good gestures and perfect eye contact. And what can I do about my voice? Some people will like it, some people won't. And my word choice, gee, I'm not that, my vocabulary isn't that great. and all kinds of ways to assure yourself that success is going to be very, very difficult if you're being made to live up to a set of standards or criteria that you're not that familiar with in the first place. Sort of the old unaccustomed as I am to public speaking, well, that's sort of what we're saying here. I don't have that much practice at this. The other says, well, I probably can, if I put enough work into it in advance, I probably can be successful in getting some main points of information across. And after all, isn't that what's more important? And I hope you can see that that's less anxiety arousing. Now, some of you should be saying right now, well, hold it now. I'm standing up here saying that communication is easy. And as a communication professor, I shouldn't be saying communication is easy, because I tell my classes every day communication is difficult, we take it for granted, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not saying that communication is easy and that getting all of your points across without ambiguity and so forth is easy. But it's easier than a performance based on criteria that you haven't had any experience with, and it's easy, relatively speaking, once you've put the effort into the preparation to make sure that you accomplish the purpose. So that, for example, if somebody has to give a speech at 1 o'clock and hasn't given any preparation to it, hasn't spent any time preparing it, and says, well, gee, I'm not sure I can get my points across, I'm not sure I can be clear, well then, yeah, sure, there's going to be anxiety there because you're not sure you're going to achieve that purpose. But given enough time to prepare, we can be fairly confident that we're going to get our points across. You're going to leave certain speeches saying, well, gee, I forgot the point about such and such, and I forgot the such and such example, and oh gosh, I'm not sure, I think I might have confused them on this particular aspect or that particular aspect. But that overall gestalt, you know, at least I know that I got the main points across, is pretty hard to miss if you're halfway decent at preparing information. So the idea here is sort of that from the communication point of view, the content's the hard part, but once you've got the content under your belt, the delivery is the easy part. And I've never met anybody with extreme anxiety who was worried about the content. And think about that. You know, people who suffer from high speech anxiety aren't worried about whether they can communicate. They're worried about how they look and how the audience is going to think they look. So that orientation makes a big difference, I think. And then I happen to personally believe, and so do about half of my colleagues, the other half don't, but I happen to personally believe that what makes a good speech is getting your points across. And once a speaker becomes convinced of that, it changes the orientation and it makes life a lot easier. I mean, two more aspects of this real quickly. Where does this performance orientation come from? I'm not sure, but I've got a heck of a good notion. I think it comes from our experiences in grade school, junior high school, and maybe high school classrooms, where we've had to orate, and where the orientation of the students and the teacher has been clearly performance rather than communication. If we're asked to recite the Gettysburg Address in front of our classmates when they've had to learn the Gettysburg Address themselves, it's pretty hard for us to see how communication has anything to do with it. And then same thing for any other examples, when the teacher is the one giving the grade, and the teacher knows the preamble to the Constitution, it's pretty hard to imagine that what we're supposed to be doing up there is getting information across to that teacher. Now, I don't think we think about this consciously, but I think the conditioning is planted subconsciously. Furthermore, when we give the book report, to which, yes, we conclude with the obligatory, I hope I've aroused your interest so that you'll go out and read the book, to fifth grade students, sixth grade students, I mean, do we really expect that they're going to do that? Maybe if we're optimistic, maybe not. But we returned to our seat, and the person next to us, at least if your classmates were anything like mine, don't usually say, gee, can you give me the name of that book again? They say, you said, 13 times. And I noticed that your hand was in your pocket from the very beginning. Then the feedback that we get from the teacher is along the same lines. Usually, the teacher waits until all of the speeches are done, book reports, recitations, whatever it may be, and then gives a sort of a composite, which prevents saying, okay, class, which aspects of Johnny's speech were not as quite as clear as they could have been? Which aspects of Susie's speech did you find most interesting? Because if you're doing a composite, you end up with, okay, now what all of you need to watch is you need to have better eye contact, and you need to have better gestures, and you need to have better this and better that. And we get into this performance orientation, I think, very early on. Then if you do take public speaking classes in high school and college, the same thing happens, and I think even worse. How are you graded? I wasn't in your class, but I bet you $5 I know the answer. The teacher has, and sometimes the students do too, which is even worse, a little check sheet of various different aspects of behavior that are supposed to be checked off. And there might be some content things on there, transitions and organization and so forth, but a whole bunch of delivery things. And then you tally up those scores, and if the tally ends up well, you make a good grade, and if the tally doesn't end up so well, you make a not so good grade. Let me give you an alternative way of grading speeches. It's a little bit radical, but it's the way I think speeches ought to be graded. It's the way I grade them when I have time. And the more important point is, when you're giving your own speech, you're the one that gets to decide how it ought to be graded, and this is the way I think they ought to be graded. Here's the way I grade them in class. I'm going to give informative speeches next week, let's say. Today, let's have all the students pass out a little exam to test the audience on what they already know about that topic. Or if it's a persuasive speech, let's pretest the audience on what their attitudes are on that particular topic. Now, in a week, you give the speech, and a week later, let's give those same tests again as post-tests. If the audience learned what it was that you wanted them to learn, you make an A. If you change their attitudes on the things that you wanted to change their attitudes on, you make an A. If you don't, you make a lesser grade. And on that test, not a single question about delivery and eye contact and gestures and all of that doesn't matter. Doesn't matter nearly as much as, did you achieve that communicative purpose? So I strongly urge you to orient that way. Now, second component, you're bound to be saying some of you will not hold it. You can't say that delivery isn't important. And as a matter of fact, I wouldn't say that delivery isn't important. But in talking about delivery, whether I'm talking to people about their stage fright or whether I'm talking to people about how to improve their speaking, again, there happens to be a much easier way. The number one most important aspect of delivery is a quality that we call directness. Directness means the audience is feeling that the speaker is speaking with them as individuals rather than orating at them. And we've all been members of both kinds of audiences. We've all sat in audiences, fairly small ones even, where the speaker seemed to be sort of orating, and we had the impression that if the whole audience left, the speaker would probably stay on automatic pilot and not even change a beat. And we've been in those other audiences where there might be 500 people, and the lights might be out, and directly in the speaker's eyes where the speaker can't see us, but still it feels like they're talking right with us as individuals. That latter example is to exemplify what I mean by directness. Now, that's what makes good delivery, is directness. How do you get directness? Be natural. Not artificial. We've seen people who sort of are naturally eloquent, and that's fine. But we've also seen people try to fake eloquence, and it doesn't work. We've also seen people that are kind of homey and go ahead and deliver the speech that way, and that's fine. I like to tell my students, think of the best actors, the best newscasters, the best evangelists, you name it. Think of the best speakers. And what is it that makes them good? One of the things that makes them good is they don't sound like they're acting. They don't sound like they're reading the news. They sound like they're in your long living room talking to you across your coffee table. They sound like they're talking the way they'd ordinarily talk, to which my conclusion is you got two choices. One is to be such a good actor that you can fake naturalness that well, and the other is just to be natural in the first place. And it's obvious, I think, which is easier. Now, everybody has one or two natural quirks that can distract if overly done, but that's where the fine-tuning comes in. Basically, be natural in delivery. And where this fits into the performance orientation is that part of this orientation says, I'm not sure that I've got the skills that are required to do a good speech. And the basic point that I'm trying to make under delivery here is that we do all have the skills to make the speech. I mean, we've heard speakers with foreign accents that we had no trouble with whatsoever because they were taking extra care to make sure that the message was clear in other ways. We've had speeches, I've seen speakers faint and then get back up and finish the speech, and I'd be lying if I said that I've forgotten that they fainted, but I do remember the speech. And as I think back over the thousands of speeches I've heard in the classroom and think of, okay, which ones do I even remember, much less which ones were the best, it's the ones that I learned something from. Every time I go to a Chinese restaurant and have to use chopsticks, I remember the speech that taught me how to use chopsticks. And I think of that speaker. She wasn't particularly eloquent. As a matter of fact, she was quite shy and reticent. But she got the point across. And that's, I think, the way to think about delivery and to think about public speaking. And then, lastly, one more aspect of this that I've already alluded to a little bit. There's a big novelty component tied up in the performance orientation. Giving a speech is something unusual. It's something strange. It's something foreign to me. It's not something that I do. I'm not used to that situation. It's new. And new situations, if they're threatening, create anxiety. If you stop and think about it, there aren't too many ways in which giving a speech is unlike conversation, at least serious conversation. Now, certainly it's unlike locker room conversation and that sort of thing, but not very many ways in which giving a speech is unlike a serious conversation. I've got a beautiful little game that I do in classes when I teach high anxiety classes to demonstrate this. Say, okay, so-and-so's turn to give the speech. Okay, look, everybody except so-and-so leave the room. Okay, just take off. So-and-so, have a seat, let's chat. What's your speech about? They start telling me, well, okay, what were you going to say about it? Okay, they start talking, we get a conversation going. Okay, look, why don't you stand up and tell me that? Same thing, conversation going. And then on cue from an assistant, the other class members, the rest of the audience, start filtering in at about, you know, two at a time, three at a time. Person keeps on talking conversationally. Few more drift in, until by the end of the speech, the entire class is there. Now, the point is, I like to ask the speaker, at what point did that conversation become a speech? And ideally, and usually what happens is they say, well, gee, I can't tell that it ever really changed, in which case the audience always likes the speech or conversation, whatever you want to call it. When people do say, well, it became a speech in my mind at such and such a point, that's always an identifiable point at which they shifted gears, went into the mode that they had prepared before they came into class, got overly memorized, overly rote, overly pat, and turned the audience off. And I like to say there are basically three differences between a speech and a conversation. One is there are more people present. The other is you talk longer before your turn is up. And the other is you have more time to prepare. Now, all three of those are pluses. The fact that you have more time to prepare means you ought to be able to do a better job of achieving your communicative purpose. The fact that you talk longer before your turn is up means you don't get interrupted, right? And all of us have been annoyed at interruptions when we had something we thought was important to say. Hey, great, you don't get interrupted as much. Beautiful. And the fact that there are more people present. Situations where we do have some attachment to, some ego involvement with the topic, and where it ought to be important to us, and if it's important to us, we ought to want to share it. And if you look at it that way, well, then it's not too much different than a serious conversation. What about this stuff that we have to be more formal? How formal do you have to be in a speech? About as formal as when you're having a serious conversation with someone you respect. You know, certainly public speaking shouldn't be like ordinary conversation of the crude and most casual kind. But ordinary conversation with people for whom we have respect is about the way a speech ought to be. You ought to respect the audience and talk to them about that way. So it's not, you know, success is not that difficult, and it doesn't depend upon a scorecard of behaviors. It depends upon getting points across. We already know that, how to do that. We already have the behaviors. We exhibit them in our everyday lives. And by the way, unconsciously, another little aside, delivery behaviors, don't think about them. In normal everyday conversation, gestures are unconscious. And facial expression is unconscious. And it's supposed to be. That's the way we're wired in. If you want to prove it, excuse me. Draw somebody's attention to their gestures. Stare at somebody's hands when they're talking. It drives them crazy. You know, when we make conscious those behaviors that are supposed to be, if you'll let me put it that way, subconscious, what happens is that they become inhibited. I have an exercise in my classes where I have people start the speeches and then I interrupt them on the spot and say, okay, look, you need to work a little bit on this or a little bit on that. Here's what happens when somebody is not gesturing enough. They're up there. Today I want to talk to you about such and such, and the reason I think this is important is because, and I interrupt and look, so and so, that's their name, not, you know, not calling them a so and so. Look, you need a little more life. You need to spice it up a little bit. And invariably, what happens is the person says, "Well, I just don't gesture. It's not me. I'm not that kind. You know, We all do it. It's just that there's a tendency up here to become conscious of it, and when we become conscious of it, then the system shuts down. So we do already have the behaviors. And the overall situation is one that is not that novel. The parallels to ordinary conversation, ordinary serious conversation, are much stronger than the parallels to Olympic figure skating and music recitals and other kinds of performance situations. So now, where am I here? Okay, I'm going to quit because I need to, but just very, very briefly, I ignored this component. It happens to be a very important one, I think, and I think the therapy that goes along with it is very important. I ignored it because I think now it's easier to see what some of the answers would be. I'm afraid I'm going to make a fool out of myself. Think about how hard it is to make a fool out of yourself in a speech. I've only seen three people do it in my classrooms, and all three of them were people who were incredibly insensitive to the audience. One had to do with insensitivity to religious feelings, and the other were racial things, where the people were just being incredibly insensitive, and the audience turned on them, not as speakers, but as persons. And that's, I think, the only way. I think that's what making a fool out of yourself means. They're going to shut me out completely and forever. Well, who's the type of person who's likely to do that? Not not the scared individual who's worried about their speech, but the one who doesn't give a hoot. That's the only kind that's going to make a fool out of themselves, and the one who doesn't give a hoot doesn't have anxiety anyway, so we don't end up talking to them, you know. But on almost all of these, from a communication orientation, you can see how, no, that's really not a legitimate object of fear because audiences don't respond that way. Okay, well, I hope you can see that there is room for improvement on all of these dimensions. I think maybe, like I said, maybe we can bring your own down a notch or two. But for those of you, if there are a few who have severe anxiety, I hope you can see that licking the problem is doable. Takes a little work, but it can be done. Now, we do have a little time left over for questions. Are there any? Yes. I've heard that it works, so I can't knock it. The question was, what about solving the problem through beta blocking drugs? Which, as I understand it, you can correct me if I'm wrong, basically wipe out the symptoms with presumably not any other side effects that are known so far anyway. I understand that it works. I've got a bias. You know, my bias says that doesn't solve the problem, that only avoids the problem, and it'll make you, if you have a performance orientation in the first place, it'll make you a calm, lousy speaker. But that's exaggerating. You know, that's exaggerating to make the point. But no, it does supposedly work. I've heard good reports. But I think it bypasses the problem in a way rather than solving it. Yeah. See, I think content is all that we need to be speaking about. You know, I don't see why speaking about other things. He's been very effective at getting certain messages across. And I don't, you know, one of the, when we talk about the quail debates and those sorts of things, you know, the media likes to latch on to sort of tertiary strategies. Did they come across looking not like a wimp or like a wimp? Did they come across, you know, looking friendly or not? Those things are important. But ultimately, of course, what's going to matter is what primary underlying messages they got across to the public. And I think those are odd situations because it would be easy to argue that we're not really looking for content, or at least some people aren't. But in an ordinary situation, an ordinary speech situation, content is what the audience is looking for. Reagan has been called a great communicator. I sure don't disagree with that. He's been very effective in many aspects of public speaking. Matter of fact, some would say that if Bush gets elected, it's because of Reagan more than Bush. You know, some would say that. That does 15 and us?
You cited the example of the 15 and us.
Yeah, that was an example from back in grade school, remember?
But that
yeah. Well, I think, let me make it a broader version of the question. I've implied maybe, and I don't mean to imply quite this strongly, that there's no such thing as a delivery problem, and there are delivery problems. Different individuals will have certain aspects of their delivery that distract. Whether it's playing with chalk or you know, leaning against the blackboard or saying and or saying like or whatever it may be. And if these things are overdone, then the audience may start focusing on those behaviors rather than on the content, and then you start losing information and then the speech becomes bad. In most cases, for most speakers, at least if my classrooms are any example, most of us will have, as beginning speakers, one or two quirks that need a little bit of refinement. But I think concentrating on those at the outset, making people overly conscious of those, will prevent them from giving speeches at all so that we can ever find out what the quirks are. I like to tell people, and I always do them after, you know, when a therapy session is completed, look, go out there, you've said that you're confident enough now to give the speech, go out there and give the speech and have a friend, you know, have someone who you trust, sit out there and be able to give you, after the speech is over, a couple of little tips on delivery, you know, a couple of little refinements, do the fine tuning, and listen to what they have to say. But if you have people worried about that at the outset, they'll never give this, if they never give the speech in the first place. So I'd say, you know, cut down on the uhs. But only after they've gotten enough confidence to give the speech in the first place. Yeah. Yeah, the question, and again, I'm going to broaden it a bit, is what about other communicative situations, situations other than public speaking in which we experience high anxiety? Some people experience a lot of anxiety on phone calls. Some people experience, most of us do, on interviews. Some people have a lot of trouble asking somebody for a date, and there are other contexts. This particular question was about telephone conversation. And I can't emphasize enough, and it's only fair to emphasize this, that the kind of therapy I'm talking about today is not a global kind of therapy that will work for anything. It won't work for, I don't think, I wouldn't claim that it does, it won't work for what we call general communication apprehension, reticence, people who are afraid of ordinary communication situations. Because if I tell them, look, it's not a performance, it's just like communication, and they're afraid of communication, ordinary communication to begin with, and then it won't fly. As for why we're afraid on the telephone, so some people are, and why we're afraid in certain situations, I'm really not an expert on that. There are people who know an awful lot about reticence. I think one little thing, though, that I can give as a tiny piece of advice goes back to memorization. In a situation like this one, where you could, where maybe you want to raise your hand and ask a question or something like that, or in a board meeting or a committee meeting, or on the telephone if it's an important telephone call, we have a tendency, I think, or at least I admit that I do, or used to say, okay, I want to get this right. Let me mentally rehearse it. Now, when I raise my hand or when the other person picks up the phone receiver, what I'm going to say is such and such. And I don't know psychologically how this works exactly, but for some reason, that memorization process that says these are the words I've got to use increases the anxiety frequently to the point where you don't raise your hand. In those rare situations where we say, okay, well, I don't have the idea formulated, it just popped in my mind, let me raise my hand now. You say the question or you make the phone call and so forth with a lot of freedom. So I would advise, you know, not thinking in terms of what am I going to say, but rather what's the point that I want to get across, and try for a little more spontaneity. But again, please don't take my advice on that kind of reticence as any kind of expertise. Yeah.
Right along with that, my question is that have any suggestions as to being able to remember better certain key words that you want to express or must express in order to get your points across?
Yeah, I've implied that memorization is a bad idea, but I've neglected to tell you what the substitute ought to be, in my opinion. And basically, this is the answer. Speak from fairly sketchy notes that serve the purpose of reminding you of the points you're going to make and the order in which you're going to make them, but not the words that you're going to use to express the points. Let the words be more spontaneous. But yeah, you write down the words on a little outline. We might show you my notes for this talk are on one page. Here are the points I want to make. Here's the order. And then you know what you're talking about so that you can just talk about it. And then don't be afraid to look at the notes. I think some speakers get this impression that, oh my gosh, if I look at the notes, that's some sign of weakness. I don't want the audience to know that I have to look at my notes. Well, Yeah, no, if you have to look at your notes, you, that's what they're there for.
In our old age, we seem to feel we need such a crutch.
It's not, I don't even think you have to think of it as a crutch. I don't even think you have to think of it as a crutch. I guarantee you if I hadn't been in my car for the last 2 hours thinking about what I was going to say, that I would have referred to my notes a lot more than I did. But it's not a crutch. That's what the notes are there for, to just serve as a reminder. What I think is a crutch is when you say, example three, and then you write it out word for word. Yeah, that's an unnecessary crutch. But when you say example three, New York, you know, and that reminds you, oh yeah, and then you tell about the New York example or whatever it may be, bingo. You know, that's not a. I mean, if it's a crutch, it's a crutch in the positive sense, not the negative sense, I think.
Okay, one more question.
Yeah. Well, now, yeah, and that again, sometimes you know there are certain gems that you want to memorize and write out. I mean, some that are just too good to screw up on. I mean, I assure you the butterflies flying in formation is not something I've used for the first time today. But generally, you know, more spontaneous. What did you say? I'm sorry?
One more question.
Yes.
You were mentioning communication orientation, and someone now said, well, the reason I'm scared is because I don't really know how to communicate to a group. What would you advise to them?
I would say that do you communicate to your friends, your lovers, your significant others about things that are important to you? How do you do that? However you do it is exactly the way that you do it up here. You know, the only thing that you said, the only significant word that I caught was to a group. And yeah, you know, if somebody says, I'm not familiar in communicating to a group, I can't argue against that. But if someone says, I don't know how to communicate, it's easy to show them wrong. You know, and when somebody says, I don't know how to give speeches, I just don't give speeches well, I've never done it well, my answer is, you've never given a speech. You've always given performances. And I guarantee you that's right in cases like that. You've never given a speech. You've never had a situation where you've said, all I care about is getting some information across to the audience. And when I meet somebody who says, well, yeah, that's always my orientation and I have anxiety, then I'll have to revise my theory, but I haven't met that person yet. Okay. By the way, I will hang around if there are other questions.